Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe.
I'm Taylor Messick.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Stone from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Foolish.
Yes, indeed. We're back with yet another podcast. We've got two more guests lined up for you, and both of them coming from the world of football. We're going to be catching up with Miguel Maron from Area 5 and also the Oz Mini Football, and also Goran Stajic, who was coach of the Western Australian Pararoos and is now coach of the Perth Glory under-13s. Promises to be a great show, plenty to talk about, and I'm really fired up. I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
Well, John, we should probably talk first about the cricket. I think I said I didn't think Australia had the firepower to get South Africa out twice, and probably proved to be the case.
Well, yeah, you're right. When you think about it, probably the best bowler was poor old Mitch Marsh, who looks like he'll probably miss out in the second test, which will probably, by the time you hear this, has already been established. Stark bowled well on the first day. You know, he fell away badly. He bowled quite... Mitchell Stark's a guy, when he bowls really well, he attacks the stumps, he attacks the batsman. And when you see him bowling rubbish a foot outside off stump, hoping to lure batsmen into false shots, you know he's not bowling well.
Well, a lot's been made about Smith not giving the ball to Nathan Lyon as much. But to be fair...
Look at his figures when he did bowl!
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. Name a spinner who's actually bowled successfully well at the Wacker in recent series. There haven't been many. I mean, if you remember, Monty Panesar got absolutely spanked when he bowled here.
But he did come back and take a lot of wickets in one day. I remember he just about bowled him to victory, didn't he, in one test?
But, I mean, look, I don't think Nathan Lyon turns the ball much. I might make myself very unpopular with that. I think he's clever in that he gives the ball air and he puts it consistently on the spot. But I don't think he will never be, put it this way, in my top 10 spinners list by a long way.
Oh, look, no, and...
Probably not even top 20. Hey,
all credit to Nathan Lyon, because like you say, he's not a big spinner of the ball. What he's been able to achieve without being able to spin the ball a long way is great. He's a very canny bowler.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. He uses flight, he uses consistency, a little bit of variation of pace.
But what he does lack, and we saw this the last time, I think we played in Adelaide against South Africa a few years ago, where he had the whole day and he couldn't get through them. And that's what you need from a test-level spinner. When he's got a last-day wicket, that's turning, everything's in his favour, that's when they've got to take wickets. And I don't think he's got that killer in him. McGill had the killer ball.
Yeah, I think Stuart McGill was an outstanding bowler.
And he was.
And I don't think he got enough recognition because obviously Shane Warne was in the team ahead of him.
Oh, for sure. And not to take it away from Nathan Lyon either. I mean, he has been very good. He is the most successful Australian off-spinner of all time. He's the GOAT. So
still wouldn't be my first choice.
If off-spinners were rated on their batting ability, not on their bowling ability, is he the worst off-spinner to ever play for Australia?
I'm trying to think. What was Bishan Bedi? Was he...
Oh, no, played for Australia.
Oh, yeah, playing for Australia. He probably would be up there. I'm not sure.
I can't think
years ago, I can't remember the guys.
Can you think of an Australian off-spinner batting number 11?
No, not off the top of my head.
Premier Leggies have batted number 11.
And Quicks as well.
Yeah. But I can't think of an off-spinner who's batted number 11. And while we're on the tail, who's bowling to these blokes in the net? Who bowls to Josh Hazlewood in the nets? Because I tell you what, it must be Sean Marsh and Peter Neville. Judging by the way that bloke bats, it's about time some of these Australian bowlers bowled against each other. Because that's who you're going to be facing when you go out in the middle. It's going to be Dale Steyn. It's going to be Mornay Morkel.
Well, I don't know if it will be Dale Steyn now. Well, it's going to be interesting whether he actually makes a comeback. And that was really sad for the series. But I think credit to South Africa. And everyone's been focusing on how poor Australia's batting was and all of that. But credit should go to South Africa. They batted well and then they bowled well, a bowler down, to still get Australia out twice.
And, you know, Steve Smith did cop a bit. But I thought he tried. Third day, He tried. He was trying things. And it just wasn't happening for him. I mean, and the drop catch too and things like that, you know. Catches win matches.
Well, I'll throw this one at you, John, because there's always been the theory in Australia that you pick your best player to captain the side. Steve Smith is possibly in that lineup, with the exception of maybe Warner, the best batsman that Australia's got. Should he be the captain? Is there a better leader out there in terms of tactical nous, leadership ability? And I'm wondering whether in this instance he's not the right choice, not because of all those things, but you've picked the best player. His game may be suffering a bit with that responsibility. I mean, it's a tough gig.
I think he's fine.
But would he be your first choice then?
Out of that lot?
Oh, yeah, out of that lot, I think he would be.
You can't go picking, you know, Greg Chappell.
No, but I think there probably are in the Shield teams, there are players that could step up.
So you're talking the English model, appointing a Mike Brearley type.
Yeah, I think at this point in time, Australia needs that.
Well, it's an interesting point. I mean, but even if you look around Shield ranks, who's the sort of guy that's in good enough form and has that X factor about him? I'm not sure that there's...
Which then that's very worrying for Australian cricket, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, there's guys of it who are older and experienced who are in great form. Maybe Cameron White. He's in very good form at the moment. And he's an experienced captain.
Yep.
A successful experienced captain. You know, I've never rated Cameron White, I must admit. Sorry, Cameron. I'm sure you're a lovely fella. But he's in the sort of form that puts you in front of selectors. Michael Klinger was last year, but Michael Klinger's not the sort of guy you'd be picking as captain, you wouldn't think.
Yeah.
He might make a great captain. Yeah.
Well, moving on from captain, I want to throw this one out there. I could not believe that Shane Warne has put his hand up, has actually admitted that he sent in an application to be the Australian T20 coach. Let's just go back to famous quotes when John Buchanan was coach and Shane Warne was playing. "I'm a big believer that the coach is something you travel in to get to the game," Warne said. In 2014, he said, "Coaching is for 12-year-olds and not international cricketers." So why suddenly does Shane Warne think he should be an international coach? I'll throw this out there. I think he misses being a part of the team, and it's his way of getting back in that. Because if you look, he, when he's had the test matches in Perth, has thrown a party in his hotel suite at Crown for all the players. But now, a lot of those players that he played with are no longer in the team, and it's the only way he can stay involved in that group is now is it to be a coach.
Well,
I think he misses it so much and he cannot bear to be outside of it.
In fairness, that's probably partly a motivation for every coach, is that level of involvement of being around it. Because once you stop playing, you're not involved.
And yeah, but to be fair, most of the other coaches have done the hard yards at Sheffield Shield level. You take John Buchanan, he went and coached Durham in the UK, then he coached a minor counties team, then he came back and coached Queensland Bulls to their first ever Sheffield Shield, you know, and then he got the Australian job. I don't think Shane Warne or any... I mean, Jason Gillespie's apparently in the mix as well. Again, there's a guy that's gone over and coached in England, had a huge successful campaign with Yorkshire. So what makes Shane Warne think he should jump ahead of these guys who've dedicated themselves to a career in coaching, whereas he's just flim-flamming, "I'll do a bit of this, I'll do a bit of that." To me, if I was Pat Howard, I'd have ripped it up and put it in the bin the minute it landed on my desk.
Well, I'm sure you'll find he has to reach a certain level of accreditation before they'll even look at him, won't they?
You would hope so. And well, I would say also a certain amount of experience.
I mean, you can't just walk into a soccer team and say, "Oh, I'm going to coach you. I've just bought Perth Glory. I'm going to coach them." It doesn't work like that. You have to have an accreditation.
Yeah, but there are ways around it, as Franz Beckenbauer found when he coached Germany to the World Cup, in that he was just named the manager, not the coach.
Well, there you go. Maybe they get around it like that. I don't know. If does Shane have much he can really impart?
I don't know.
You'd think he knows a lot about spin bowling. I wouldn't take him on as a batting coach.
But again, if he's going to take that role, does that mean he should relinquish his role with Channel 9 as a commentator?
Absolutely.
Because to me, there's a massive conflict. You can't do both.
Absolutely, you should. Well, it's only the T20. So, yeah, he can commentate in the test matches and do all that, but then he's in a position where he's making comments about people in a public arena that are potentially, yeah, you know, you've got all those other sorts of issues. Hey, we mentioned Steve Smith before. My mate, Aleem Dar. I love Aleem. That was one of the best wickets I've ever seen, best decisions I've seen in a long time from an umpire, because it was out. Now, we saw an instance in the second innings where he fired Mitch Marsh. Now, if you saw that live, you would be shaking your head. If you saw what DRS said about it, you'd be shaking your head some more. That applies equally to the Smith dismissal. I don't trust that ball-tracking rubbish. That's complete rubbish.
John, we've talked about this for a long, long time on this show. I've never been a fan. I don't believe that a computer can tell you exactly what a cricket ball is going to do. I've played enough games and seen balls do really weird things where it hits a crack, suddenly it shoots along the ground and doesn't bounce, and it never or rarely bounces the same height every damn delivery.
It can hit the same. There's too many variables.
Exactly.
Absolutely too many variables. The one on Mitch Marsh, that was about as not out as you get. There was no way that ball was hitting the stumps.
Look, I don't think you should be using it for LBW decisions personally, and I've always had that stance.
But going back to the Smith dismissal, umpires, since the introduction of television replays, etc., have been under tremendous pressure. And even though it's now legalised within the game, it's not just television companies showing these replays afterwards and going, oh, the umpire stuffed that up. You know, it's now part of the system that the game uses. They've been sitting back and they've been watching these replays, and the umpires have still been copying it. You know, when they make a bad decision, the people involved might say at the time, oh yeah, well, the umpires have it tough and rah-rah. They always add the but word in there somewhere. And so there's always this idea that the umpires dudded us. We got dudded. Over the years, umpires have been watching these replays. They like cricket. Umpires, believe it or not, do like the game. They like watching the game. And they've seen all those replays of guys running down the pitch, getting hit on the pads, them giving them not out, the replay showing that they're actually out, but commentators saying things like, well, he was a long way down the pitch and so he can't give him out. And this is umpires' revenge. This is throwing it back on the players and the administrators. No, these are the laws. That's out.
If the ball's going to hit the wicket, and it's going...
You
if
could
it's
be standing
along,
10 feet from the bloke and get hit in the middle of the head. As long as it's going to hit the stumps,
if it's
you're
staying
out.
Low and it's going to hit the stumps... There's no argument.
So cricket people have got to be very wary about the way that they look at the dynamics that's happening between umpires and play and all those sorts of things. I reckon he's been waiting to do that for a long time. He saw the opportunity because his finger came up real quick. He wasn't waiting around thinking, oh, no way. He fired him. Bang, you're gone, son.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe, and you're listening to Not The Footy Show.
Well, our first guest on this show is actually a man who's just resigned as the head coach for the WA Paralympic football team, and that is Goran Stajic. We spoke about his achievements at the national championships recently before he announced his retirement, and we thought it was very important that we have a chat with him about a program that is really going from strength to strength here in Western Australia. Goran Stajic, welcome to Not The Footy Show.
Hi, everybody. How are you going, all?
Well, the reason we're catching up with you is, I think it was with some regret you've stepped down from the WA Pararoos. It sounded like it was a relationship over 3 years that you really relished.
Yeah, it was an absolutely amazing experience, Ash. So, in saying that, I think it's just wonderful. It's going to give someone else an opportunity to come in with a different eyes and ears, and hopefully they can take that next step further, and that's to win it.
Obviously a fantastic achievement. When you took over, they came fifth in the Nationals, then they came fourth, and this year, not many people picked them to come second.
Yeah. You know what, it'd be big of me to say that I did, but only because I know how hard we work. We probably worked the hardest this year. So we started in January, and as we're getting closer to the date, the boys were certainly just really looking like they're in for this, and... I looked over to my assistant coach, which is Michael Owens, so name dropping, but you know, just a lovely chap. And he was new to the sport, and I didn't know what to expect. But when I got him on board and convinced him that we can actually give this a good shake, so I wasn't surprised at all. But unfortunately, we just fell a little bit short at the end there.
Just for listeners who wouldn't know what the Pararoos style football is about, it's obviously people with cerebral palsy and also coordination skills from a mental point of view, isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, so predominantly each player has a form of a disability, with it, whether it's cerebral palsy or an acquired brain injury, which they call an ABI. And it's a seven-a-side football game, which is probably played, the dimensions would be 18-yard box to 18-yard box. That's just shorter, but the width is predominantly the same, and it's also, there's no offside in it, so it's, I always call it that hybrid game of like water polo on land with that basketball sort of end-to-end sort of stuff. You've got rotating substitutions in the Australian nationals, but in internationals you've obviously got the three substitutions that you have, but yeah, I mean, honestly, it's just in such a pure sport, you know, in that sense, if I can use the punt, because these players just as skillful as what an able-bodied athlete would be. Believe you me, they might be predominantly a one-sided player, but who's not these days, anyway, when you think about it. So, yeah.
And there's some of them are actually playing quite a good standard in the state leagues, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got some boys over in the East Coast and that who've actually played in the NPL in Queensland. And then we have some other players in New South Wales who ultimately play in, the lower leagues. And even here in WA and that, you know, we've got boys who are playing NPL juniors and the older guys are playing amateur football.
It has been fantastic. What I think as well is good about the achievement that you had is those guys could have got so demoralised when they lost their funding for the Pararoos as a national team. But in fact, they all really clubbed together. They fought via social media, etc., to make the sport get the recognition and find the funding, and also put the FFA in a position where they were a little bit embarrassed, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not too sure about whether the FFA were embarrassed than that, but it certainly raised a few eyebrows in that sense. But once again, it just goes to show you about these athletes and that they really believed in their sport, they really believed in their ability, and they certainly, got the funding that was required to get us over to the World Championships last year. But let me tell you, one thing that I did really, really find out, it wasn't just the athletes in itself, it was the people around them who really believed in the sport, who really have been involved in it for such a long time as well, since 2000, to be fair. So, and now we're starting to raise that profile, and full credit to the FFA, you know, because they didn't really have to probably put their hand up as such for a national team, but they did, and they've really endorsed it and really backed the Pararoos now. So watch out, you could have a household name Pararoo very, very soon.
I certainly hope that's the case. What was your biggest challenge, though, coaching a group of guys like this? Because obviously I would think it's very different challenges to your natural able-bodied team.
Yeah, absolutely. So a perfect example on the training track would be that we'd have a player with an ABI, for example, an acquired brain injury, and, he's basically can't hear, so he's got cochlear transplants there, yeah. Implants there, and I'm shouting out, and then the boys are shouting out to him, and it just has to turn around, so you just resort to sign language or whatever it may be, you know. So that was certainly a bit of an eye-opener at the start, in saying that he's a phenomenal player, who actually plays in abled 11-a-side football. Some of the other ones are also cerebral palsy. Some of them, if they're a hemi, which means one side of their body, which means that they will suffer like a hearing loss as well on one side. So that's probably one of the big ones. And the other one would be that they might not be able to cover the distance as quick as you'd like from what you're used to in 11-a-side football. But over time, you start really appreciating their strengths and weaknesses, and you just try and put that together so it just complements each other and you get the balance right.
And we've spoken to Chris Barty on many occasions, and I know there's a guy, again, who worked really hard at his foot speed because he was a goalkeeper, which, again, he wanted to be able to move across his goal slightly quicker than his opponents.
Yeah, Chris Barty's an absolutely such an inspirational person to be around, and I've had the privilege to be able to coach a fine young man like Chris, and he just always wants to get better. He always wants to be better, you know, and if you could imagine, he works, like you and I, 9 to 5 or whatever it may be, and out of his own pocket, he would actually get his own one-on-one coaching. I think it was with Dave Wally. Yeah. I still believe he still sees Dave Wally. And if that wasn't enough, it was probably football, you know, or fitness or conditioning or whatever it may be. And with this recent result at the Nationals, I dare say I was really pushing hard for Chris, because Chris was one of the founders of WACP football, and he really deserved to have that 15 minutes of fame, you know. So, yeah, absolutely fantastic person who deserves everything, and he's still going strong and trying to get back into the Powaroos as well.
And he's also taken up athletics now, and he's doing really well at that.
That's correct, yeah. Unfortunately, he just missed out on the Rio Olympics, you know, in that sense. But hopefully we don't lose him to athletics, and that he will concentrate and focus on his football, because he's certainly a very, very important part in both the WA and the international team.
One person you mentioned in your sort of, I don't know if it was a retirement speech, was Gordon Deuce at Football West. He, to me, has always been a silent achiever at Football West. You talk about people working in the background and in the periphery, but he is another one that works tirelessly.
Yeah, I mean, I've been once again fortunate enough. I mean, when I went into this job, I didn't really know what to expect, other than to just think to yourself that I want to make some new football friends. And Gordon is probably beyond a friend. I mean, this guy is just absolute, an amazing human being, first of all. But most of all, this sport is very, very close to his heart as well. It just gives everyone else an opportunity to, you know, play at the elite level. He doesn't stop. He's just always, hey, Gordon, I think I found another one. Or, you know, have a look at this one. I'm going to try to get him down on a Saturday. You know, they're just type of, you know, scenarios that Gordon's done. But, you know, I always wondered, you know, if there is a succession plan for Gordon. Because I think coaches can come and go and walk through and that. But I'm not too sure whether Gordon Dusters can walk in and walk out like that. You know, the guy's an absolutely a huge asset, not just to the sport, but to the football community of WA for sure.
No, I must admit, I agree. I think he's deserving of some award somewhere, because I've seen him for a number of years, and as you say, tireless work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so I'll nominate him unofficially for the Australian of the Year for sure. Absolutely.
Now, just turning our attention back to the results, I mean, you had a really good tournament. It was 4-1 against Queensland, 3-1 against Victoria, 2-2 against New South Wales, who you then met in the final, and then 6-0 against the combined states. After that 2-2 draw, did you think, come the final, you know what, we can take them?
Yeah, I mean, I probably want to just touch on those previous results and that, because they were not as easy as what the scorelines say. Definitely not. They were just, you know, some of those games were decided probably in the last, you know, 5 to 10 minutes and that, because with CP and ABI, fatigue can play a factor, which probably can in any sport, really, in that sense. But 2-0 up against New South Wales in that round robin, and probably 10 minutes away from, you know, causing a major, major, major upset. But did I think we could win the final? Oh, for sure. Absolutely. It was just a matter of, you know, bit of luck this way, bit of luck that way. But something happened in that tournament that really kind of shook up the balance a bit. What happens is players are classified. And we had a classification that didn't go our way as such. So we had to go back to the drawing board and try and get the balance right for the final. And it worked out for the first 20 minutes, but unfortunately, I mean, New South Wales, too big, too strong, too good, you know, yeah. And we know what we have to do next year, and, you know, with people like Chris Gordon, you know, the new coach, Mick Owens, the assistant coach, don't, you know, I'm sure that they'll get it right and get that recipe right to cause a huge upset next year for sure.
Now, one door closes, another one opens. You're now involved with the Perth Glory Youth, and are you enjoying that?
Yeah, I mean, Perth Glory is definitely one of those jobs that I think any coach would like to put their hands up for. So I was very, very fortunate to be offered a position there. So I'm coaching the MPL juniors, under 13s, and you know, it's practically 4 or 5 times a week. Something as a coach that you strive for. I mean, as an A-licensed coach, and you'd like to obviously go into a full-time capacity if you can one day, but this is definitely something that I'm really looking forward to and enjoying for sure.
Under 13s, and if you've got that much time with them 5 times a week, I would think it's much more than just what happens on the park, that you're more of a mentor or a guide to what they can become as men when they grow up as well.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, for sure. I probably look at it like this. When players come to me, they come to me at a certain level, and I'll know it's a successful season if they leave me hopefully a little bit higher than the level that they came at. And that would probably also mean as an individual, as a person, as a, you know, as a citizen, and something like that. I always tell the boys that if there's anything that you want to talk to me about regarding football, I'm always here. But if it comes to girls or anything such as that, I'm probably not the person to talk to. But mentor, it's a big word, and I think you'll always strive to conduct yourself in the best possible way as a coach. But for me, really, it's just about the player, you know, and who they are really, both on and off the field, I guess, yeah.
I think finally one thing that really comes through is you're passionate about the game, and I think when you're a coach and you're young, you want someone who's passionate to inspire you, and I think maybe that might be the reason why you've been successful. Do you feel that that passion does run through your body every day?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I mean, earlier when I first started coaching, I reflected back on my previous coaches, and the late Mel Brown and Leo Morocchi, I see him at games and stuff like that. You know, it's a synonymous Morocchi name, you know. And I remember when they were my coaches, how they came to every session like it was a brand new session. There was just so much excitement, and I just wanted to come back as a player. So I think that's a big tick in itself. Whether we, you know, win, lose or draw, we still wanted to come back, and that's something that I wanted to instill in my own philosophy as a coach, and that I wanted to make sure that the boys wanted to come back, wanted to learn, wanted to become better, wanted to be better. And that keeps me on my toes as well, to make sure that I'm always interactive with them and trying to just challenge them and ultimately just make every session better than the last. Yeah.
Well, Goran, great to catch up with you, and congratulations with the Pararoos, and we wish you all the best in all your future coaching.
Thank you very much for having me along. And I just think if anyone really is interested in Paralympic football and that, please contact Football West, Gordon Duss, and just see how you can help. Believe you me, even if you're not a coach, there's people out there who've jumped on board, and they've really grown in love with the game. So, thank you very much for having me.
Hi, I'm Derek Underwood, and this is the Not the Footy Show.
Now that was Goran Stajic, as we mentioned, who was the coach of the WA Paralympic football team. And it was a fantastic achievement by them to get through to the final and play against New South Wales. And you do feel, John, when he mentioned there about one of the players being reclassified during the tournament, I tend to think if the authorities have classified players that they should reclassify after the tournament's over, not during it.
You know, there's a touch of Monty Python's about that. You know, he turned me into a... She turned me into a newt. But I got better. I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense, does it?
Well, it just seems very harsh. And it's also very... Not just unfair on the coach who's got to adapt, and unfair on the team, but it's unfair on the player who, you know, he has been assessed originally and classified as this particular...
Well, he doesn't do it himself. He doesn't tick the I am this on the form, does he?
Exactly, and just wanted to touch on the fact that Chris Barty was voted goalkeeper of the tournament, and also congratulations to Nicholas Prescott, who was named WA's most valuable player in the tournament as well. So it was a really good performance by Western Australia, and hopefully they find another coach who has the passion and the drive that Goran had for the program. And it was also really good to hear him acknowledge Gordon Duce at Football West, who, you know, I've always been a fan of Gordon, and I know how much work he does behind the scenes, and it's great to hear people appreciate his work.
I did hear a Melbourne pundit on the radio the other day say that out west that we didn't have much of a football culture.
Oh, really?
And I should send him those results.
Yeah, we don't have one for AFL. That's dwindling fast, I think. Just before we do move on, John, I don't know if you saw Benita Merciades, who we had on the show, I don't know, what was it, about 5 months ago.
Yep.
She wrote a piece on the annual report that's come out of the FFA, and it was quite interesting reading, is probably the best way to put it.
It's a summation of the annual report?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is interesting.
You know, the thing that got me was that
there's lots of questions in it, not many answers.
Yeah, I mean, 10 staff members at the FFA earning over $500,000 a year.
Are those 10 members included in the ones that gave themselves a 13% pay rise in the last 12 months?
Well, it sounded like it, didn't it, when you read this article? I mean, again, when you consider what the Matildas were being paid, and I know for a fact that some of the girls playing in the W League are not getting paid anything, and some of them are only getting as little as $150 a game. So you could play in the State League and earn more money than players in the W League, which is meant to be the highest women's competition, and we go and see staff at the FFA getting a 13% pay rise. To me, it's absolutely disgusting.
Snouts in the trough, mate. That's all it is. It's snouts in the trough.
But it's so wrong, John, and I mean, this is where football needs to have a good, hard look at itself. I think it's top-heavy in management, and that goes for Football West here, and I've said that for a long time. I think the last time I looked, there were 14 managers for 22 staff. That's top-heavy in any business. If it was a private business, you would go broke with those levels.
Yeah, and I mean, when you talk about the pay deals in women's football in this country, and then you look at what Melbourne City's been able to put together, and you start asking questions, don't you? Because Melbourne City get a lot of concessions these days.
Hi, I'm Daniel Ricciardo, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Now, we are going to turn our attention now, I think, to our second guest, because it seems appropriate while we're talking about football. And Miguel Maron is the man behind Area 5 Football, which is, if you've seen it at the various bowling clubs, it is a five-a-side tournament there. But he's also putting together the Oz Mini Football, which is going to be taking place on the 26th of November from 8 to 5pm at J.A. Lee Reserve. And it's a six-a-side tournament, but I believe that he's had so much interest now that it may be over 2 days. Your best bet is going to be to contact Miguel, but just let's hear a little bit more about the tournament.
Miguel Maron, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thank you very much.
Well, wanted to catch up with you because I believe you're the man behind the Mini Football World Cup, which looks a really exciting thing.
Yeah, that's it. I've been appointed to be the president of the Australian Mini Football Federation and also Oceania to grow everything that is small-sided around this area.
That's fantastic. Now, what's your football background? You're from Mexico originally, and we know they're probably the best team in Central America.
Oh, well, sometimes, eh? But yeah, I used to play 11-a-side in second division back home, and then I play 5-a-side and 7-a-side in the highest level, and all mini football, so I actually loved it more than 11-a-side, because, you know, it's a little bit more a bit more friendly, you know, at the end of the day. It's just, and it's quick game, and it's, you know, it's just fast, and it's just an amazing game, to be honest. I love it.
And how long have you been in Perth now?
I'm going to be 5 years now, mate. 5 years.
You've even got the mate going. That's good. Australian there. But tell us a little bit more about the Mini Football World Cup. You know, how long has it been going, and where's the finals held, etc.? Because people have got the chance to represent Australia.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Well, look, what happened is the World Mini Football Federation has been, well, basically it started all from the European Mini Football Federation, and they've been running mini football competitions for ages, and it's pretty massive over there in Europe. They do, and you know, like European Championships every year. They go all around Europe in different cities, and there's an attendance of 500,000-600,000 people every event. So the World Mini Football was created just recently, about a few years ago, and the achievement is to grow mini football around the world, not only in Europe, obviously, and it's been growing everywhere now. It's Mexico, the US, you know, South America, Africa, everywhere. So now we're in Australia trying to pump that up, and it's a bit of work, you know, because, you know, at the end of the day. Nobody knows what it is, but, you know, that's what we're here to show, what we're trying to do. And we're trying to invite everyone to come down, and you know, we're doing the qualifiers in Perth at the end of this month, on the 25th till the 27th of November, and the top four teams of each city, so that will be Perth, Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane, those four teams qualify to the grand final in March, and the team that actually wins all the competition will go to Tunisia to represent Australia in the World Cup of Mini Football with all expenses paid.
Fantastic. Now, you mentioned that obviously the four teams from Perth, where will the finals in Australia be played? And do they have to find the airfares or are they covered as well?
Well, we're deciding if it's going to be in the Gold Coast or Sydney. It all depends what's available and what will be, you know, the easiest for everyone. We know the people from Perth, obviously we're far away from everyone. So I'm trying to, you know, get some sponsors on board to help us out, to try to at least help people to, you know, at least pay half of their trip or help them out with something, because I mean I live in Perth and I know it's not easy to, you know, pay $500 and then pay for a hotel and stuff, but you know it would be good to, you know, like get the people on board first and then after that try to help them out with some kind of, you know, money or whatever it comes up to, so they don't have to spend too much money in traveling on the East Coast.
Now, with the teams, are they all male? Is it over 18s? Are there age limits on it? Can they be a mixed team, or what's the story?
Well, at the moment, this is only men's open. Usually, the World Mini Football and the all mini football, we do juniors and we do women, but at the moment this is just concentrated on the men's World Cup, and it's, you know, it's open, you know, 16, 18 years old, if you have those skills, you know, and you think your team will be the best to go and represent Australia and be the, you know, the top over there, then it's so good, you know, it doesn't matter what age you are, you just have to have to bring the big guns down.
And if people want to get involved with it, how can they do that? How can they register, and when's the cutoff?
They can register on the website. It's ausminifootball.com. It's ausminifootball.com. Or they can just, you know, get on the Facebook and flick us a message. Everything's on the website anyways. And, well, the cutoff time, we're trying to do it, you know, maybe about 3 or 4 days before the event, so we can, you know, get all the draws up in there. But so far we have about 10 teams registered here in Perth, and I mean it's not as we were expecting to have, you know, we want to have more, but East Coast is just massively, we have calls from the East Coast all the time asking where is in Melbourne, where is in Sydney, where is in this, when is it happening, you know, so it seems that the East Coast is pretty interested in it, but I mean hopefully the people in Perth wake up and say, well, hold on a second, we have the skills, you know, we can do this, let's go and represent Australia.
Well, certainly I've seen the posters everywhere at the moment, so you've done well to get those out. I mean, are you seeing teams coming from, say, maybe indoor futsal competitions, or are they coming from state league clubs, amateur clubs, or is it just guys throwing a team together?
Mate, we have from everywhere, eh? 11-a-side, indoor, outdoor, 5-a-side, 6-a-side, everywhere, like everyone's invited. There's no restrictions here, you know. I mean, if you know how to play football, because at the end of the day, it's football, you know what I mean? So, yeah, everyone, any skills, anything.
Now, some people might go, what's mini football? They know futsal or they know 5-a-side, but it is pretty much 5-a-side, isn't it, outdoors? Or?
Well, yeah, it's all I've got is involved 5, 6, 7-a-side. Oh, everything that FIFA don't recognize, you know, FIFA just recognizes 11-a-side, futsal or beach soccer. So this is just everything that doesn't have to do basically with FIFA. It's just a different federation, a new young federation.
Now, you mentioned in Europe, obviously, that it's become really huge. Is that a sort of national competition, or is it the club side sending teams to participate?
Oh, well, it's everything, you know. Like I mean, some clubs get interested and they send their people, but I mean, I have a couple of clubs actually very into. I spoke to them and say, yeah, we're putting a couple of teams in. But others than just people that sometimes people don't even play 11-a-side. They're just a couple of mates having a go and just to have a little bit of fun and have that opportunity, you know, because they know they have the skills, but you know, it's that's it.
So. You mentioned the take-up's been slow in Perth, but if you think about it, if anyone's listening to this, perfect opportunity for you to come in, 4 spots up for grabs, and, you know, you've got a really good chance of going through to the national finals representing Western Australia. So I'd say get your applications in. But the other thing I'm thinking about that is, in a way, it's going to take time. People tend to be a bit suspicious, a bit slow on the uptake here to take new events into their heart. And maybe, you know, this time it needs that that first one, and then people are talking about going to the Nationals or maybe even going to Tunisia, and then next time you're going to have hundreds.
Yeah, well, look, some people will be like, oh, what's that, you know? Like, this is just new. We don't even know what it is. But what I have to say is we're not only doing this for the World Cup, but the achievement is we're trying to bring the Asian Championships to Perth and obviously Australia. We're trying to bring the World Cup of Mini Football as well. So this gradually is going to increase, and it's going to awake that interest into the soccer players, you know, to see a different kind of football getting involved in Australia.
Now, one of the other things you've got is Area 5. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that, because I think it's a really good way to keep some of the bowls clubs surviving.
Yeah, well, Area 5, we've been doing it for 4 years now, and we're obviously expanding. We have three venues now, one in Big Park, one in Wanneroo, and still the one in Lake Manga. And next year we're going down to Coburn, and we're pretty excited. It's 5-a-side. It's outdoor synthetic grass. You can wear your molded boots, and we're creating this new, you know, environment for the community. And it's just growing, and we're pretty happy to what we're doing is pretty good for everyone. And also we're doing probably a lot of people don't know about this, but we're doing the Champions League starting next year. So we're going to start, you know, playing with other venues around and create a little bit more of that great atmosphere of what is mini football.
So with Area 5, is it a very serious level, or are there some teams that literally go there for the physical exercise and to be around a few mates?
Well, look, some people come just for the fun, but like at this time of year, you get all these good players that come from the 11-a-side, you know, State League, NPL, and they come and play competitive. But at the same time, you know, they know it's just a social game, and they really enjoy it. And it's just the thing is, you have to come down to watch it. It's just amazing. But it all depends. You know, some people, you know, have a little bit more of seriousness in there, but some people just want to come down and have fun.
The thing I think that's good about this, and I remember Rob Barn, who was the technical director at the FFA, he said the big problem in Australia is we only play football for 6 months of the year. Places like your Area 5 now give those children the opportunity to play all the year round.
Absolutely, absolutely. We're open all year round. Like, I think the only time we close is, well, close for competitions is the 3 weeks during the Christmas time. But everything else is open, you know. Like, I mean, even if we're closed with the competitions, you can still come and hire the pitch and come have fun with your friends, you know, and just have a drink after, or maybe a barbie or whatever, you know, play some bowls if you're in a bowling club. So yeah, no, it's exciting, it's good for the community, and we just want to grow it and just throw it out there for the community just so they know what's happening around.
Well, Miguel, I wish you all the best. The one thing that comes through is your passion for the game and your passion for the work you're trying to do.
Yeah, no, I'm to be honest, it's a lot of work involved. A lot of people think it's just, oh, yeah, you just set up a 5-a-side, it's easy, but actually it's a full-time job, and it's actually very, very, very hard job. But I'm happy, I'm passionate about it, you know. I've been playing football all my life, and just want to grow it in a nice, healthy way and try to get everyone, you know, together instead of being separated around. You know, we want the football to be unique and one, you know, so that's our aim.
Well, thanks very much for your time today, and good luck with the Mini World Cup.
I appreciate it. Hopefully to see you down there.
Hi, I'm Thomas Abraham Hearn, and you are listening to Not the Foodie Show.
So that was Miguel Maron from the Oz Mini Football. And if you do want to get involved with that, go to their website. It's www.ozminifootball.com. It is taking place the 26th of November. As I mentioned before, we heard from Miguel, it may well now go over to the 27th because registrations are there. And it's a great opportunity. Top four teams in WA going across to what is believed to be the Gold Coast for the national finals. And the top team, John, you know, you go to represent Australia at the Oz Mini, well, at the Mini Football World Cup, and it's all expenses paid for you, your team, to go to Tunisia. That is a great prize.
Tunisia.
I wouldn't mind going there.
It'd be interesting. I'll give it that. Look, fantastic prize. Why wouldn't you? Oh, excellent, amazing opportunity for people that probably were never, ever, ever going to play international football.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you see the posters around Perth. But if you're interested, get in touch. You don't have to be part of a club. You can put together a team with your mates. And who knows, because sitting opposite me is a man who's a state champion in the past as well. And he got in, just entered and never expected to have that on his CV. And that is, of course, John Lee.
Yes. Rock, paper, scissors world has never been the same.
But a sport that is dear to your heart, John, is, of course, hockey. And we had the Hockey Australia Awards for 2016. And Fergus Kavanagh won the Kookaburras Player of the Year, while Jodie Kenny won the Hockey Roos Player of the Year. And it was sad that neither of them were there. But to me, it was even more sad to hear that Fergus Kavanagh has retired from international hockey.
Oh, yeah, these things have a level of sadness about them, but I don't think it's a surprise in the sense that Fergus is of that age where these decisions, athletes have to make these decisions, especially in sports like hockey, where there's not a lot of financial benefit from playing.
No, you're absolutely right. And as Mark Knowles, who accepted the award on his behalf, said, you know, Fergus is engaged to a lady in the Netherlands, and so he's over there playing professionally at the moment, so it makes sense for him to focus his life, at, for the time being anyway, in the Netherlands and try and get, obviously, the next phase of his life set up. But it's very sad. And I always feel Fergus has been almost an unsung hero because, as Terry Walsh said to me, probably one of the greatest tacklers ever in the game.
Yeah, he's a fair player, Fergus. And you're right, he very much went under the radar because, like in most sports, it's the blokes that score the goals that get all the accolades and stuff. But he was a tremendous, tremendous player. Still is.
He is. And I mean, you mentioned that Jamie Dwyer took out the Kookaburras top goal scorer for 2016. Not a bad achievement when you're the oldest player in the squad.
Oh, no. I'm going to get hated now. Well, it's no surprise Australia's Olympic tournament ended up the way it did when Jamie Dwyer is our top goal scorer for the year. I think if you follow the logic of what I'm saying, it's
no, I do. I think that we were too reliant on Jamie, is what you're trying to say.
Well, and there's no one, not reliant. He's the only one that, there's no one else coming through. We're reliant on him in a de facto way, if you know what I mean. He could have still scored exactly the same amount of goals he did this year, but no one was stepping up to match him.
I think there are a few players coming through. I think Flynn Ogilvie is one who could step up to that mantle. Maybe forever. He's not obviously at Jamie Dwyer's calibre yet, but he can score goals. Jake Wetton, unfortunately, had injuries leading into the Olympics, and I think even he would admit was not in peak physical condition come the Olympics, because all he'd been doing was running and running and running and running, you know, and hadn't been actually playing.
Yeah.
But it was a great shame. Just looking at the women, though, Emily Smith and WA's very own Catherine Slattery, they shared the women's award. And another good thing for two WA players was they've got the inaugural Personal Excellence Award. And that's where people from the hockey world are doing good work in the community. They are also helping promote the game. So it's an education, community-based. There was a whole criteria that they had to meet. And Tristan Clemens shared that award with Rachel Lynch. So it was good to see not only a man and a woman, but two Western Australians taking
that
award. Pardon?
Isn't that two goalies?
Two goalies as well. Was indeed.
Well, they've got a lot of time goalies. They don't do much in the field, you know. They just stand there in that bloody net.
I dare you to say that in front of those two. And, of course, it was a joint event with the Hall of Fame, and we had Stephen Davies, known as China, inducted into the Hall of Fame.
See, they could do with him in their forward line at the moment.
Well, he's coaching the women's forwards.
Free air player.
And Jen Morris was inducted. Also, Roslyn Knoll, who was formerly Roslyn Fisher, and Gordon Pierce, one of the famous Pierce brothers. Yeah. And an award of merit went to John Leese from Busselton. And I think his wife was an umpire. He was a coach. And son played as well. Hockey really in the family. And, of course, Rochelle Hawkes was upgraded to legend status. And Rick Charlesworth will be receiving the same honour in Melbourne in a couple of weeks' time.
Well, they run a great Masters tournament post-season down at Busselton. It's much enjoyed by the participants.
And we should congratulate, while we're on hockey, the Boroughs, the young under-21s, because they actually won the Sultan of Johor Cup for the first time ever. So that was a really good achievement. I was really disappointed because I was meant to have been commentating that, and for some reason the organisers refused to comply with the Malaysian Hockey Confederation rules on some issue, and so it was pulled from television and I didn't get to do it this year. So it would have been even more special had it been there for Australia winning it for the first time ever.
Yeah, well done, young lads. Great effort. I mean, like you said before, there is a lot of good talent coming through.
And you'll be pleased, John, because they've announced the team for the Under-21 World Cup, which will take place in India in December. And there are a couple of boys from WA. Fraser Gerrard from Cottesloe. And alongside him is Matthew Bird from Coolbullup,
yes,
which is your neck of the woods. So
just around the corner, as it happens, actually, from where we're sitting.
You'll be very pleased to know that he's made it into the team, and we wish them all the very best heading into the World Cup.
He's a good kid, Matt, and I wish him all the best. Hopefully one day he'll become an integral part of the Australian hockey team.
Well, certainly we need a few more WA players to step up.
And, it's not the good old days.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not the good old days in cricket and in a lot of other sports either, you know.
Nah, exactly. Now, I don't know if you've got anything else you wanted to say. Just one thing that came through actually today from the Australian Rugby Union is that they've committed to a review of the 2016 to 2020 Australian Rugby Strategic Plan. That was following a meeting of key rugby constituents in Sydney. Now, ARU Chairman Cameron Klein said, obviously a major part of the discussion was around the game at the community level, and that's where a lot of the emphasis will be placed in the review of the current strategic plan. Our plan is to commence the review early in the new year, and we'll continue to work with our stakeholders to get the right outcome for the game. Everyone in the meeting had only one concern, and that was the best interests of the game of rugby. And I think what that means is that, as we've seen in so many sports, the focus at the moment is too top-heavy. It's very much on the international teams, the Super Rugby teams, and they're forgetting grassroots. And if you forget grassroots, you will kill the top end eventually.
Mate, how many times on the show have I said, if you've got enough milk, you'll get plenty of cream?
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, staying with rugby, just one to finish with. We saw the Irish knock off the All Blacks.
How brilliant was that?
Think back. Think back a few years. Can you remember the last time the All Blacks were on a winning streak like that, and they got beaten? They got beaten, I think, one game prior, or equaling the record.
Yeah, they were level with the record before, which was 17 consecutive wins, which South Africa achieved and England had achieved. Of course, Romania beat that, but they're not a top tier competitor.
Well, do you remember that streak was broken by a loss to the Wallabies in Hong Kong?
Yeah,
that game was played in Hong Kong. Once again, their run has been stopped by the Irish this time, in Chicago. I would suggest to New Zealand rugby, they don't play games in non-rugby playing countries.
Very good point.
It just struck me as a funny little, almost like it was destined that was going to be the game. Oh, we want to finish this winning streak, let's go to Chicago.
Well, there was actually a really good video clip that I put on Not the Footy Show's Facebook page. Remember we had Liam Dunseith the other week, who's the coach of the Iranian Sevens team, and he put together an analysis of that game and basically how many penalties New Zealand gave away and how many of those penalties that they gave away resulted in points to Ireland. And that was pretty much where they lost the game. They just gave too much ball back to the Irish.
It'll be interesting to see if a different referee had have refereed the game, whether the score would have changed.
I must admit, Steve Hansen was pretty gallant in defeat, saying, look, you got to lose occasionally.
Oh, you do. And when you won 18 or 19 on the trot, you know that the next loss is around the corner. It's coming.
Yeah, it was 18 in a row. And also when you think 111 years it had been since Ireland had beaten... Well, they'd never beaten the All Blacks.
Well, of course, when you link that loss in Chicago to what happened with the Cubs, 108 years, and it's within two or three days of each other happening.
Yeah. You imagine the Irish bars in Chicago.
Oh, mate, going crazy.
Also, if you look, also within the same space, Andy Murray going to the world number one in tennis, the first time, and I always love this, the first time a Briton has topped the world rankings since they came into being. It's funny how when Andy Murray does well, he's British. When he does badly, he's Scottish.
Oh, there's been another winner this week too. I look forward to the next USA-Mexico game in football. That should be interesting.
See ya. We'll be back next week.